This is a complicated story. Pay very close attention. The seemingly disparate details do eventually tie into each other. Bear with me. Listen to the full hour. It begins with a man in a basement.
And I'll tell you what the magic words are. I really want this job. Did I say I like what I hear? Did I say I'm interested? No. What am I saying?
I'm desperate.
That's how Susan got hired. She said, I really want this job.
That's Barry Cohen. He is well dressed. He has impressive cheekbones and an indefatigable smile. He reminds me of some 20th century titan who wants you to sign on the dotted line for a set of steak knives. It turns out I'm not far off in my speculation. You see, Barry has experience selling dictionaries door to door. He has this curious equation on the whiteboard that's just behind him, where he's written out this formula for impression management. 60% dress, 23% dialogue, 17% demeanor. It all adds up to 100%, which is, after all, the percentage you need to get a job in an economy that's tougher than the stalest bread you can buy from the direst bakery.
And I have to tell you, long after you walk out of a person's office, they're thinking about you. The next question you ask is, what is the next step in your hiring process?
These days, Barry is a university employment coordinator at CUNY, who is spending a hot Wednesday evening in June in the basement of a public library, addressing the unemployed on how to find and get the jobs they really want. But I'm thinking about the people assembled in this room. Forget about hiring process. What is the next step that they have in their lives?
The power of making a first impression, I think that's very important. And given the statistics that he said about, like, the first 7 seconds, the first 30 seconds, you know, you only have, like, one chance to make a good first impression. So I just wanted to get some tips from him. And he was very good. He was excellent.
I was laid off from an insurance job. They eliminated the department.
Five interviews in 2 months is pretty good, I think. What has your day-to-day life been like between those interviews and also looking for work? How do you get up every morning and do more of this?
Well, I'm very motivated because it's very exciting looking for work, and there's a lot of searching to do. So there's a lot of things that you can go for. You're not necessarily going to get the job, but there's a lot of things out there, particularly for me, because I'm open to several different types of jobs.
I graduated last year. The problem is taking the bar. You know, it kind of takes up all your studying. Yeah. So I've been looking on, I would say close to a year now.
Yeah.
Yes.
And how many interviews do you think you've been on? What do you think's been going on lately?
Well, I mean, the law market is hard. You know, there's a lot of lawyers. There's a oversaturation of lawyers. However, I have gone on several interviews. One of them made it to the final round, but didn't get selected for some reason or another. So at this point, you know, I'm just looking for help, you know, and that's why.
You're looking for any kind of tips, any kind of hints to kind of
get
beyond that?
Yes, definitely.
Food service, art, event management, a lot of different things. It's best to, like, write down things that you're interested in and then kind of go for those things that you're interested in, and maybe not look for under the classified or job boards or something. Maybe go to something like, if you want to work at a particular restaurant, go to that restaurant and try to find out how to get a job in that restaurant without being invited.
How do you stay positive? How do you stay alive?
Well, I'm a born-again Christian, so for me, God is definitely the biggest part of it. You know, sometimes I get down on myself, but, you know, praying to God and just speaking to Him every day, and honestly, a lot of the recent events that's happened to me these past couple months, passing the bar, meeting this attorney, that's just given me reassurance that everything will work out, you know.
When a good chunk of your time involves sending resumes into the unresponsive ether, you need every bit of encouragement you can get. And Barry Cohen has given these people the reassurance they need. When Barry's lecture is over, I ask him how he got started speaking before a crowd of hopefuls. It turns out that despite his clear confidence and charisma, he's working from an altogether different, vicarious place.
I do lectures at the 92nd Street Y, Sybil, 14 colleges.
I really started doing it years ago when I was doing outplacement, and my boss at the time wanted me to give a presentation to dislocated employees. And when I stood up in front of an audience the very first time, I tried to talk and I got nervous and I stuttered. And I saw people staring at me because I realized they were waiting for me to stutter again. So I walked to the other side of the room, I continued to talk, and I blocked again. And afterwards, it was very painful. I went back to my boss, Peter Jess, and I said, "Peter, this is terrible." And he said something I never forgot. He said, "Brag about your weaknesses." I said, "What do you mean?" "Tell them you stutter." I said, "Why should I do that?" "Because you're showing them how you handle adversity. If you stutter, they expect it, and you become human." I said, "Really?" And so the second time I got up to talk, I tell people I stutter, and it was a slam dunk.
I was curious, you have a bandage on the side of your head. What did that come from? Was it a shaving accident?
No, what happened, I had a mole on my face, and I had a dermatology appointment. And he said, "Do you want me to freeze it?" And I said, "What do you do?" I said, "I just squeeze some stuff on it. It drops off." He said, "Okay." So we squeezed it, and it didn't drop off. It's still here. And so I'll take it off. So I thought coming into class with a bandage on my face would look a little weird. So I put these two little things on it, and I'll take them off because...
Am I the first person to ask you about this?
No. She did, because it'll dry if it's... You see it?
Oh, I see. Yeah. You mentioned writing resumes for people who had just been let go. I mean, was that sort of the early germ of being a guy who's sort of on this particular scene, trying to get people back on their feet, trying
to... Sure. It's very empowering for me to help somebody get back on their feet because I understand what it is to lose a job. You know, for most men, and not being sexist, a job is something they hang up their hat with. It validates them, it creates them, it gives them prestige. And when you don't have that to hang your hat on, it's devastating. When I sold dictionaries, I had a script to rely on. So I knew what I was going to say. I had answers to all the objections. I want to think it over, it's too much, it's too low. But I realized that when I was sending people out for an interview, they had nothing to rely on. So why can't I use the same techniques in training salespeople as I do training job seekers and give them answers and then giving them a coach? And when I was happy with what I had, try to get them hired. Susan Lee is a prime example.
What about the unemployment situation? I mean, we recently had legislation passed locally in which you can't discriminate against people who are unemployed.
But they do.
Yeah, they do anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, in some cases, it's not necessarily a person's fault. It's just that there are not enough jobs to go around. I mean, what do you tell someone like that
who's in that? There are enough jobs to come around. There are. The job, absolutely. The jobs are coming back. I see them every single day. In my career with CUNY, I placed over 10,000 students, okay? So I know the jobs are out there. However, that doesn't mean they're going to hire the first or the last. I mean, look what the competition is. Dislocated workers, people who retired and can't afford to retire, college grads, high school grads, MBAs, and anybody in Topeka, Kansas who wants to come to New York to work. So the talent pool is big. That doesn't mean they're good, but it's big.
Yeah.
And so that's why I said in class, the best people don't get hired. The people who know how to attack the marketplace and know how to get hired, get hired.
The national unemployment rate continues to hover just under 8%. It's been like this for about a year. That's higher than the 1991 recession. And the unemployment numbers are starting to match the recession of the early 1980s, just before unemployment hit over 10% in 1982. This program looks into whether or not the jobs are, as Barry says they are, really coming back, or whether we're avoiding a very serious problem, one that we don't have the courage to stare in the face, and one that permanently alters lives. We talk with Dr. Michelle Holder about unemployment discrimination. Economics professor William Dickens talks with us about beverage curbs, and playwright and activist Barbara Garson tells us how all this has been going on during the last 4 decades. My name is Edward Champion, and this is Follow Your Ears, Episode 7, Unemployment.
The central tendency of their projections of the unemployment rate for the fourth quarter of this year is 7.2 to 7.3%. declining to 5.8 to 6.2% in the final quarter of 2015.
The question I was going to ask was, could you give us some information on substantial improvement? Is that the unemployment rate coming down by itself to 7%, or are there other factors involved, and is it substantial compared to the fall? Is that when?
Well, there are many factors.
Last Wednesday, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke participated in a press conference. He told reporters that we were at the beginning of the end, predicting that unemployment would fall between 5.8 and 6.2% in 2015.
I think that's an optimistic prediction.
That's William Dickens.
2015 is still a long way away.
He's a distinguished professor of economics and social policy at Northeastern University.
And we shouldn't be willing to sit back and say, well, 2 years from now, the unemployment rate's almost going to be back down to where it was when we started into this recession. We shouldn't be willing to settle for that.
I'm talking with him because he's co-authored a policy paper with a PhD candidate named Rand Gayad. The paper involves something called a beverage curve. Now, that's not the curve that happens when you take a parabolic swig from a glorious can of beer. No, the beverage curve is the relationship between job openings and unemployment. But the policy paper has shown some alarming shifts that we haven't seen since the 1980s, and it was enough to frighten certain journalists who didn't have time in their schedules to pick up the phone. I am hoping Professor Dickens can help me demystify the beverage curve. I found the public policy paper that you co-authored with Rand Gayad after reading this Atlantic article by Matthew O'Brien, which was called, "I Can't Stop Looking at These Terrifying Long-Term Unemployment Charts."
Right.
So, to explain to our listeners what's going on with these beverage curves, I think I wanted to start off by asking you, are these charts the most terrifying you have ever seen as an economics professor?
Oh, no. Every day when I look at the unemployment rate, I'm much more terrified by that than I am by the charts themselves. And part of what my work on this has been is to argue that the shift in the beverage curve really isn't as bad as some people have made it out to be. Some people have been trying to argue that all of the increase in unemployment that we've seen at this point is structural, that there's something wrong with the way the labor market's functioning, which would mean that the Federal Reserve and Congress couldn't do anything about the unemployment rate. But I don't believe that's true at this point. I think we still have a ways to go in our ability to put people back to work.
So if the beverage curve's shift outward isn't as bad as people have said it to be, then I'm curious how it actually reflects our present unemployment problem. The only other time it did this, as you point out in the paper, was during the 1970s, where you had vacancies rise without any dip in unemployment, and of course during the 1980s. So what comparable conditions between today and the 1970s and the 1980s would cause this beverage curve to shift outward, and why do you think that it's been overstated? What does this really say for us, Professor Dickens?
Sure. Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. More and more, I think what we're actually coming to believe is that this shift in the beverage curve isn't like the last shift in the beverage curve. And an important part of what Rand's work has been about is showing the differences between the shift in the 1970s and the shift now. The shift in the 1970s, no one's quite sure what caused it. But the general belief is that in fact, the labor market was functioning less efficiently for about 10 years from the late 70s to the late 80s, maybe even longer than that. And that during that time, we couldn't get the unemployment rate down much below 6.5% without causing inflation. There's a number of differences between that episode and this episode now. For one thing, it took 5 or 6 years for the unemployment rate, for the beverage curve to shift out back then, and for the unemployment rate to reach this sort of new equilibrium level at this higher rate. This time it happened in 6 months. And so we think that that's one really important difference. Another thing that Rand has pointed out is that the last time that we saw this sort of change happen, it was across the board. It would happen in all parts of the economy, happened to everybody, and that in terms of occupations, in terms of industries, in terms of age differences, in terms of lengths of unemployment, everybody saw this greater difficulty of matching workers and firms. And that's led some people to speculate that it had something to do with geographic mismatch, that this was a period of shifting of industry from the northeast and the central part of the country to the south, and that it required migration to take care of that. Other people have suggested that it was a change in wages, that some places that there were over the wages were out of whack for a while, and that made it hard for employers to hire. But this time we're seeing it's something very different. We're seeing that it's concentrated only among those with long-term unemployment, which is something that's new in our economy. That is that typically we haven't had very many people who have been unemployed for more than 6 months. And recently it was up as high as half of our unemployed were people who had been unemployed for more than 6 months. So that's more like what goes on in Europe, where they have high unemployment, and a large part of the high unemployment problem is long-term unemployment. And so we're thinking that what this shift in the beverage curve is showing isn't something like the last shift, but rather this change in that there's this group of people who are just sort of excluded from the labor market as a result of their long-term unemployment.
Just to be clear on this, the difference between the beverage curve that took years to actually move outward versus months, there's no clear-cut reason for this. I mean, there's just basically a lot of theories as to why this has happened.
Yep. This is something a lot of people are interested in understanding, and we're among them. We're working on this.
I asked Professor Dickens about the unemployment rate remaining at this stubborn level of just under 8%, and whether there was anything about beverage curves then and now which upheld Chairman Bernanke's predictions. He told me that an unemployment rate of 6% just wasn't good enough.
We shouldn't be willing to settle for that. We should want to get the unemployment back down to where it has been historically. Now, this is where the issue of the beverage curve comes up. If there really has been a shift in the beverage curve that's like the one that took place in the 70s, we may not be able to do that. And my own estimate suggests that if this beverage curve shift is like the old ones, then we're probably not going to get the unemployment rate down much below 6%. But like I said, I don't think this shift in the beverage curve is like the old one. I think that aggressive policy could put us back down into the range that we were in before the recession. I would hope that the Fed wouldn't give up and wouldn't settle for unemployment around 6%, that they would want to see it go lower, and that they would continue to be aggressive in pursuing stimulative policy until the unemployment rate is back into the range that it was before the recession.
So, to reiterate, Professor Dickens is telling us that not only is Chairman Bernanke wildly optimistic in his projection that unemployment will fall below 6% in 2015, but that this roseate number isn't good enough. And we also have this graphical representation, the beverage curve, this curve that charts the relationship between job openings and unemployment, and this curve has taken months to shift outward when the previous one in the 1970s took years. And nobody has a clear-cut reason about what the hell this all means. But long-term unemployment is one of the big reasons. I talked with Barbara Garson, author of Down the Up Escalator, to get a more sociological view of this problem. She told me that we shouldn't look at the recession. It's the American workers' dwindling prospects over the past four decades that's partly to blame for all this. Barbara could see this through a man she befriended named Dwayne.
It wasn't the recession. It's been the last 40 years that American workers have been earning less, or let's say at best keeping even, which is, I think, what he did.
So the decline of the American workers' fortunes for you really clicked in when you could see it from this generational legacy.
Right, and I felt bad because I had used him in an early book, as well as I knew him personally, as an example of how we were all talking about how, well, if productivity is increasing so greatly, do we want to have shorter hours, or do we want to do hand work, or do we want to produce more for the rest of the world in longer hours, as if we had those choices.
Yeah.
And it turned out we didn't have those choices, did we?
No.
The choices were made by people who really took the entire benefit of the greatly increased productivity. I mean, from the time that I met Dwayne in 71 to the time of the recession in 2007, productivity had increased by 99%. That is, it nearly doubled. And wages had stayed the same. And somebody took the benefit of all those, it went entirely to profit. And the profit was not used to do anything good for anybody.
Yeah.
That money accumulated and accumulated. And finally, it was lent to workers that decided, I'll tell you what, I won't pay you more. I'll lend you the money to buy back what you produce. And of course, anybody can hear that that's not, you can't do that forever.
Garson found further examples of this generational income divide with a group of newly unemployed friends who formed an informal group called the Pink Slip Club. But only one of the Pink Slip Club members, a man named Feldman, seemed especially concerned with how he was going to support himself, in large part because he couldn't take the insecurity of being a freelancer after 13 years. I asked Garson how much this reflected the new normal of unemployment, where an unemployed person now waits 3 months for a short-term gig.
The Pink Slip Club is a group of friends. They met each other through their church. It was a Wiccan church, but they through the church, they realized that they were all unemployed. And they started to get together in order, they thought, to keep themselves company for a few weeks when they could enjoy. They live in Manhattan. They put almost all their income into living in Manhattan because they earn about $50,000 a year. And they were going to enjoy the city, go to free concerts, which they did, play Scrabble in the afternoon, which felt terribly sinful, go to a movie in the afternoon where a friend had a pass for a press screening. And they did that for a few weeks.
Did you find them through your own Wiccan connections?
No, I wasn't a Wiccan. In fact, I tried to tell the truth, but for a while I sat there with that truth and said, maybe I shouldn't mention it. People will think they're not normal, but they were so completely normal and typical. But I mentioned it as I always try to tell the truth, a little bit. They're not taking back anybody full-time just because the business is coming back. I talked to many people and saw them through a process during which the company changed the job right during the recession. And one of the people who was working at a fancy clothing chain, it was so well known that even I knew the brand. And she had been a saleswoman who had won the prize of the first, biggest commissions for several years during her stay at this company, which will be 25 years. I soon will be able to tell you the name of the company because she says she's quitting in October when she's got her 25 years.
Yeah.
Now, she stayed because she was, she loved doing the job. She loved dressing people. And her husband had all the benefits she needed, and it was as if she was already retired. But what happened was the company came in and took away everybody's commissions, started telling them that the job is now, every 2 weeks they put out your schedule, and they tell you how long you're going to work for the next couple of weeks. And that was going down to 5 hours, 6 hours. And I said to them, well, do they say, we're really sorry, this is because of the recession? And, she said, no, and I don't think it is because of the recession. She said, because if you notice, they're taking on new people.
Yeah.
New people who fit better into this 4.5 hour schemes, college kids. And they have said to us, if you want to quit, we will let it go as if we let you go. You can collect unemployment insurance. It's as if this company, which had taken away all benefits, was making unemployment insurance a benefit for quitting.
Yeah.
So they really wanted to change the nature of the job. They have changed the nature of the job. There's nobody left but her from the old regime of full-time professional saleswomen. So what I'm trying to point out to you is that the process that I watched for 40 years of jobs becoming more lower paid, more less benefits, but particularly more insecure, you just fit in with the company's orders that week, that process didn't stop during the recession. And oddly enough, it often does. And so it didn't stop, but rather it just continued. So, and that's the process that led us into the recession. I mean, made people not have enough money to buy what they produce. So it's as if we ran into this terribly deep pothole, climbed out, and have continued on in the same direction even more rapidly than before and with much more worn tires. I mean, the next thing, which I cannot predict, which probably won't be another housing mortgage loan thing, but will could be a student debt, but some kind of credit explosion that comes from lending people money they can't pay back. That's the next thing.
All this talk of businesses using unemployment benefits as an incentive for quitting has Barbara and me pondering what we can do for the unemployed while they wait for a job. I persuade Barbara that much of American unemployment, especially long-term unemployment, is permanent.
But if it sucked out your drive and your reason for being, it is permanent for a lot of
That's
people.
True.
It takes
That's
on
true.
A permanent disposition that, well, I've busted my ass every day, 8 to 12 hours, filling out online applications, sending in resumes, and no one has actually responded. I've had a few interviews after like 6 months of this. Well, this is exhausting. I mean, you know, it's really kind of ironic.
Now you're making me think. I wonder if there's any kind of activity we can create. I mean, that brings people out into the world, without money, it's very hard. Gives them a sense of responsibility and cooperation with them. If there's anything really fun and wonderful.
Well, that's
or
what
at least
the Federal
fulfilling.
Writers Project did. That's what the WPA did.
Without money, if we don't have the money to put into it, I wonder if there's anything we can self-do that would be worthwhile. I'm just wondering, you know, like one of those, I told you I had this thing that went on 30 magazines, and one of them raised a fund for to pay writers $100 a piece.
Yeah.
And when I got that $100 check, I mean, I thought, well, I'm an established writer. I don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
But when I got that $100 check, I felt much more for real.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if there's anything we can do without the money. Let's assume the government is never going to do a WPA and is never going to do the environmental things we need done. If we don't have the money, if we can't tax to do it, is there any way we can nonetheless bring people together in a way that will be feel a little better, make unemployment into what you're saying, into something, a chance to do something?
Occupy Sanity did a remarkable job of
yes.
taking unemployed people and giving them work to do to actually relieve communities that were hit by Sandy. I went to Staten Island and I even did a segment on this.
Wow.
And it was amazing. They charted data. They kept the data anonymous so that it was available for everybody to look at later to see what the devastation was, who needed help. And it was amazing. I mean, they were doing everything to get equipment. They asked people for money. It was an extraordinary organization, and it was a great sort of way of taking people who could not find work. And it was also a great way of putting a new sort of momentum into the Occupy Wall Street movement, which had kind of declined a little bit and was going through some infighting. And then the Occupy Sandy thing came in response to Sandy, and it did wonders, and it's still doing wonders today.
So you're answering one part of my question, which is it has to be a real necessity.
Yeah.
You have to be fulfilling a real social purpose.
Sure.
If we got everybody together and said, oh, let's paint the sidewalks in some beautiful color, well, it would be therapy, and it would be seen as therapy very quickly.
But if you're building or erecting
right.
something that's quite amazing, or you're actually...
But then you start needing some money to put into that.
Yeah, yeah, you can't...
Or in the case of Occupy, in case of Occupy Sandy, the people who came out weren't getting paid, but they knew that at least for this short period, they were essential.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, if we're not paying people, I mean, it's really sad, but if you don't pay people, they have to be very inspired to feel it's real.
But it's difficult to feel inspired and real when the deck is already stacked against you. One little discussed truth about being unemployed is the rampant discrimination against job seekers who are not presently employed. The situation is so bad that New York City was forced to pass Introduction 814, a groundbreaking piece of local legislation that made it illegal under the human rights law for an employer to base a hiring decision on an applicant's unemployment. That went into effect a few weeks ago. I spoke with Mitchell Hirsch, the web and campaign associate at the National Employment Law Project, to get a better handle on just how bad discrimination against the unemployed remains. It turns out that Introduction 814 doesn't nearly go far enough. Job discrimination against the unemployed was first reported in the summer of 2010 when local media in Atlanta discovers this Sony Ericsson ad which reads, "No unemployed candidates considered at all." So I have to ask, to what extent did unemployment discrimination exist before 2010, and how widespread is discrimination against the unemployed now?
Well, I would say before 2010, it existed on a more limited scale. I mean, it's always been a kind of truism that it's easier to get a job if you have a job. But during the recession and the early part of the recovery, as job openings began to improve and companies started to post more job openings, this kind of practice started to rear its rather ugly head increasingly. And right about that same time, the summer and fall of 2010, was when we started having folks contact us to let us know about some of these job ads that said things like, "The unemployed need not apply," or, "If you apply for this position, you must be currently employed." And folks were letting press in on some of those job opening postings as well. And that Atlanta Journal-Constitution piece really kind of kicked the whole thing off in the summer of 2010.
Yeah, and I see that in the briefing paper that the National Employment Law Project issued out, there's this very helpful appendix in which you discover more than 150 ads that discriminated against the unemployed using the language "must be currently employed" and so forth. We now have the Fair Employment Opportunity Act of 2011, and in New York City, Introduction 814 has gone into effect in the last few weeks. Do you think these legislative measures are enough to prevent discrimination against the unemployed? Do you think companies will continue to find loopholes? Is there any data you have that suggests that these measures are going to be enough to stop discrimination?
Well, the only legislative initiatives that have been enacted thus far that go to the underlying practice of employers or their agents excluding people from consideration for employment regardless of their qualifications simply because they're not currently working have been in Washington, D.C. and New York City. And the New York City bill, which, as you say, became law earlier this month, is the strongest in the nation because it allows people to bring complaints not only to the New York City's Commission on Human Rights, but also to take private action in court. Is it enough? No, I don't think so. It is necessary to address the problem because it is so pervasive and so harmful. But in and of itself, I think legislation is not sufficient. The real problem is changing the behaviors that have become, unfortunately, rather ingrained in the hiring community and human resources departments, and particularly among recruiters and staffing firms. And those behaviors, which basically say if somebody doesn't show a current employer on their resume, that resume is put aside, and that person is not considered for a position simply because they're currently out of work, or in some cases because they've been out of work for 3 months or 6 months or what have you. And that's the practice that really needs to change. And hopefully the New York City law will help foster that change.
If it doesn't go far enough, perhaps we should talk about how it came into existence in the first place, because we've had previous recessions, we've had previous downtimes, and we've never really seen that must be currently employed in job advertisements before. Why do you think that this started becoming common?
Well, I think in part it's because the whole process of filling job openings has gotten, like so many other things in the economy, has kind of been outsourced. A lot of the hiring, initial recruiting for consideration for jobs is done outside of the actual employer's business. And the competition for fees associated with filling jobs from job applicants is fierce. I mean, the recruiting business is a tough business. The staffing industry is a very competitive industry. And so one of the kind of perverse things that's occurred as a result of this outsourcing of the hiring process is employers have turned around and told staffing firms and recruiting firms, we'd prefer, we'd really want you to send us people who are currently employed. And we definitely don't want to see people who've been out of work for 3 months or longer, that kind of thing. And so the recruiters and staffing firms get to turn around and say, well, that's what our clients told us. And meanwhile, you've got literally millions of people kicked to the sidelines simply because they don't meet these new qualifications of having to be currently employed. It's really perverse.
Yeah. So if we're talking, though, about a business friendly, that whole code word, that is always used in relation to, it's almost offered as an excuse as to why you don't hire someone who has been unemployed for a period of time. I mean, what do you do as campaigns coordinator to persuade a company that they can't do this? Have you had any success in changing a company's mind at all in your capacity at the National Employment Law Project?
Yes, actually, when this whole issue of job postings online, having language excluding people simply because they weren't currently employed. We made quite a fuss about that based on our research. The report you mentioned, when that came out, the New York Times ran a major feature front page in the business section and an editorial on the very same day. And so this issue, based on the visibility that these job postings online gave the underlying practice, kind of raised a red flag. And so companies became increasingly hesitant to actually post job ads with that kind of language. And due to some of the publicity that we helped bring to this, one of the largest online job posting sites, Indeed.com, announced shortly afterwards that they would no longer accept those kinds of job postings.
I put in several phone calls and emails to Indeed to get them to comment on this story and this policy. These phone calls and emails were not returned. So Introduction 814, a local law in New York, helps to allay discrimination against the unemployed. A business, Indeed, also ends discrimination in its ads. And the question that anyone listening to the show who is not in New York and who does not use Indeed is probably asking right now is, well, hell, how does this matter to me? Well, remember when I told you at the beginning of this show that the national unemployment rate continues to hover just under 8%? And that it's been like this for a year? And that this was higher than the 1991 recession, and that today's unemployment numbers are starting to match the recession of the early 1980s, just before unemployment hit over 10% in 1982. Let's return to Professor Dickens.
Paul Volcker, chairman of the late 70s, early 1980s, Paul Volcker, the head of the Fed at that time, took it upon himself to say, let's solve the inflation problem, even if that means having a period of sustained high unemployment. And so we had a really bad recession in 1982 that was deliberately triggered by the Fed in order to bring inflation down. They really beat inflation out of the system with that. And then they brought the unemployment rate back down after 1982 as quickly as they possibly could to a range that that at that point was, as we said, was a little bit higher than what they'd had back in the 1960s. And so for a while then we were at this new normal with the somewhat higher unemployment rate.
We talked about the new normal of unemployment with Barbara Garson. But is this new normal worse than the old new normal? To get a better understanding of how local policy reveals national policy, I spoke with Dr. Michelle Holder, the senior labor market analyst at the Community Service Society of New York. I asked Dr. Holder why New York was a good microcosm for America.
Well, I think it's a good microcosm because the groups that are basically, I'd say, occupying the least enviable positions in the U.S. labor market are well represented in New York City. For example, African-American or Black unemployment in New York City is quite high. It's the highest of all major demographic groups. And actually, Blacks are well represented in New York City. While African-Americans are about 13% of the U.S. population, they're about 25% of the New York City population. Mm-hmm. Similarly for Latinos, Latinos have the second highest unemployment rate in New York City among major demographic groups, racial and ethnic demographic groups. They're over 25% of the population. So the groups that, as I said, are experiencing problems, you know, lingering, persistent problems in the labor market given the post-recession climate, are basically well represented in New York City.
Yeah. So let's talk about this. In New York during 2009, the unemployment rate for women was 8.9%. For men, it was 10.4%. But then something interesting happens, or not particularly pleasant, but interesting happens, and that is between 2000 and 2011, the pattern changes. Women's unemployment rises, men's unemployment starts to follow. And you say that a lot of this has to do with the massive loss of public sector jobs in the city.
Yes.
What other factors created this, and how much was gender income disparity part of this problem?
Sure. You have obviously done your research because I did say in my report that part of the reason that women's unemployment rate went up in New York City while men's unemployment rate went down during the post-recession period was because there was this incredible loss in public sector employment, not just at the federal and state level, but particularly at the municipal level. And so women are overrepresented in public sector jobs. They constitute slightly over 60% of public sector employees, federal, state, and local. And so any significant hit to that employment sector, and people don't tend to think of government jobs as a true sector, as a job sector. It is a job sector. Lots and millions of people work in the public sector. So any hit to that sector is going to hit women disproportionately. The other thing that you may have seen in my report is, which was an also interesting phenomenon, is that men actually started to drop out of the labor force.
Yes.
So the way that that official unemployment statistics are calculated, you actually have to be what they call participating in the labor force. And by participating, they mean either you have a job, or if you don't have a job, you're actively looking. And so there's actually, you know, a group called, you know, not in the labor force. If, you know, when someone like me who looks at labor market stats all the time, you can actually measure, you know, how that grows or contracts based on demographic groups. And so men, relatively speaking, started leaving the labor force while women stayed in, yeah, in New York City. Particularly older men started to drop out of the New York City labor force. And so what happens is when a group starts to sort of leave the labor force en masse, they're no longer counted in unemployment statistics. So, and let me just give you an analogy here. So I don't know how closely you follow like U.S. labor force statistics. When, you know, you hear on the radio, oh, the national unemployment rate is 7.9% and 7.7%. Yeah. And then what we've been hearing quite often over the last several months is, well, the national unemployment rate came down because a lot of people left the labor force.
Yeah.
And so if you look at this issue in terms of politics, right, you'll have Democrats hailing that, like, wow, you know, the president's policies have worked, unemployment has come down, and then, you know, those who don't agree with those policies or politics will say, no, the unemployment rate came down because people are discouraged, there are not enough jobs, they've left the labor force, and that's true. So it's this, the analogy is that at the New York City level, when men, particularly older men, started leaving the labor force, they were no longer counted in unemployment statistics. So as a result, their unemployment rate came down.
Yeah.
So you had sort of two things going on. You had, on the one hand, women working in a sector where they're overrepresented and which was contracting significantly. And on the other hand, you had men, particularly older men, leaving the labor force in the post-recession New York City landscape. Combining those together, it looks like during the post-recession period in New York City, women were doing comparatively worse than men. So you have those factors going on.
This seems as good a time as any to bring up what Ben Bernanke was talking about Wednesday, and he was insisting that unemployment would fall. But I was talking with a distinguished economics professor, Professor Dickens at Northeastern University. I'm sure you're familiar with his stuff, his work on beverage curves.
Oh, wow. And that takes me back. Beverage curves.
Yeah, which he was telling me.
Our Fed has a dual mandate. It's supposed to take care of both inflation and maintain full employment. And so throughout the late 1980s, early 1990s, the Fed actually did a very good job of maintaining both very low inflation and very low inflation and very low unemployment. The big recession, arguably the Fed did very well in offsetting the initial impact of that. It did everything it could. But the Fed's main instrument for affecting the economy is interest rates. And once they got those interest rates down to zero, you can't go much lower. You can't go any lower than that. And so they were more or less stuck. They had to come up with new ways of affecting the economy. And those new ways aren't as effective as just manipulating short-term interest rates are.
Essentially, the Fed is helpless right now because they can't raise interest rates. And so the idea of controlling unemployment, it really falls upon Washington. It falls upon state and local levels. What is your takes on this? And what about New York City? I mean, we're talking about the public sector and how this had a huge impact when New York made the decision to eliminate public sector jobs. This had a huge effect on unemployment. So what could be done? I mean, what of this?
Well, yeah, I'm actually glad you brought up the issue of the Fed and the Fed's role in what has gone on in terms of unemployment in the nation and in New York City. So the Fed's sort of toolkit, I would say, was limited in terms of really making a significant dent in national unemployment. You know, they control monetary policy. They don't control fiscal policy. So, you know, within their kind of bailiwick, they could lower interest rates. That would hopefully spur people to invest a little bit more. Interest rates are down.
Yeah.
Borrowing costs less, right? But that actually didn't seem to work. I mean, unemployment, it's only in the last quarter of last year and this year have we really seen national unemployment come down. New York City is taking longer. Actually, I believe the New York City unemployment figures were released last week, and I do have to say that I don't know what the New York City unemployment rate is right now. I should have checked that before you got here. But needless to say, I'm pretty sure it's still above the national level. So in terms of going forward, what role the Fed could play, I think that from what I've been reading, the Fed is considering raising interest rates because I think Bernanke is feeling that the economy is headed in the right direction, at least in terms of major labor force indicators. Again, U.S. unemployment rate has come down. But its role in terms of job creation is really limited. And I agree with you. It really falls on the doorstep of the folks in Washington, our policymakers in Washington, our representatives in Washington. They're the ones really that could play, I think, the more critical role here in terms of keeping the economy on the right path.
Let's talk about another form of governmental intervention. You suggest that New York State take advantage of a new federal provision in the Middle Class Tax Relief and Job Creation Act of 2012. This allows demonstration programs using unemployment benefits as wage subsidies to decrease long-term unemployment. This is modeled after the Georgia Works program.
Right.
My question for you is, since this doesn't really cost employers anything, and the workers in Georgia get little more than unemployment benefits plus the $240 to cover travel.
Yes.
You know, to my mind, this seems to me almost like a federally subsidized unpaid internship to some degree. I mean, how could you assure continuous employment under this provision? I mean, businesses have to pay for labor, right?
Yeah. So what we were suggesting with using this particular provision in federal law is that employers actually commit to keeping someone on for a period of time. I think we were suggesting either 3 to 6 months after the expiration of the UI benefits. So what, because we also, as you astutely pointed out, we also recognize the fact that, you know, once someone's UI benefits are up, what's the incentive of the employer to keep this person on? The employer has gotten this person's labor basically for free. So in order to mitigate, you know, an employer enrolling in this program, bringing folks on, they get, you know, sort of job training. The employer gets labor. And then at the end of the person's UI benefits, the employer says, well, you know, we don't have a slot for you. What we were proposing, what Community Service Society was proposing, is that the employer do commit to a period of time to keep this person on, unless there is some serious performance-related issue.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. The question is can you actually persuade any employer in a tough economy, in an economy that favors business-friendly, to really go beyond the UI benefits? Do you have any tangible examples you can cite that employers are actually doing this?
No. So with the Georgia Works program, we did find that it was having a positive impact in terms of unemployment in Georgia. This is something that we're proposing. So it's, you know, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So we wouldn't actually know whether or not asking employers to commit to a period of time after the person's UI benefits expire would work. We don't know. We're suggesting that this may be something that's a win-win. And also, when you think about it, an employer... Why would an employer participate if they didn't need the labor? Like, why even bother to go there? So our thinking is that the attraction to the employer is getting some labor up front where they can test someone's skills. They can see if someone works out in a position. And if so, well, keep them on for a couple of months. So it's something we're proposing. We don't know. We don't know if it would work.
But if the reality is that businesses will go ahead and let someone go once the UI benefits are done, mm-hmm. I mean, is this nothing more than, I mean, maybe this is sort of an artificial way of sweetening the unemployment rate. You know what I mean? Georgia Works is as much of a loophole as those who actually drop out of the actively seeking work part of the sector?
Well, the thing, again, what we're proposing is that it's a firm commitment that an employer cannot enroll unless they agree to keep a person on for a period of 3 to 6 months afterwards. So if there's no intention on the part of the employer to do that, this program is not something they would be eligible for. It has to be a contractual commitment. So is your question more about why would employers do it anyway?
Well, I mean, I'm wondering, I was looking and doing some research on Georgia Works, and I couldn't really find employers that had actually kept people on past the date, you know?
Yeah.
So if it's being touted as a sort of policy success, I immediately become sort of skeptical. It just seems like just as another way of sweetening a problem and not looking it straight in the face.
Yeah. Well, what we were suggesting was not exactly like the Georgia Works program, simply because there was no commitment on the part of the employer to keep employees on after the expiration of UI benefits. So we also recognized that that was a problem. You know, again, why should an employer keep a person on if there's no obligation to do so?
Yeah, absolutely.
So
let's talk about one of your other recommendations in your 2012 paper. You suggested that New York City should increase efforts to attract mid-skill level jobs. We were talking earlier about how they basically killed off a good chunk of public sector jobs, which might actually fall under this category. Are there any positive developments along these lines that have made any dent in local unemployment whatsoever?
Not in terms of mid-skilled jobs. There have definitely been efforts on the part of Mayor Bloomberg to attract high-tech industry to New York City. That's bought thousands of jobs. It's been very successful. There's also been efforts on the part of Mayor Bloomberg to attract, I don't know what it would be called in terms of technically, but the movie industry, right? To you know, do more filming in New York City. Brings jobs, you know, it's appealing. It presents New York City in a good light. But there really hasn't, to my knowledge, been that I've come across any sort of efforts on the part of the current mayoral administration to really attract good, solid middle-class jobs. So I think a lot of the effort has been either in sectors that pay very well or in low-wage sectors, retail, hospitality, leisure, restaurants, that. But there hasn't really been, there's not been a lot of attention, I should put it that way, put on the fact that solid middle-class jobs are really kind of shrinking in New York City. So I would not say that there hasn't been successful job creation efforts in New York City. I think there has been. I just think that it's been skewed in terms of the types of jobs. And what we're seeing is, I think, kind of a contraction of the middle.
Yeah.
And I think that that's just a kind of a phenomenon that is basically occurring not just in New York City, but kind of across the country. And it's also something that I think had not, I wouldn't say a lot, but also something to do with the Occupy Wall Street movement, that they correctly kind of identified that, you know, not only is inequality, you know, there's this sort of shrinking middle class, and there are a lot more poor people and there are a lot more wealthy people. But along with that are jobs.
Yeah.
So it's not just, you know, shrinking middle class, but it's also shrinking mid-skilled jobs and a shrinking pathways to the middle class.
But do you think that Mayor Bloomberg is really committed towards burgeoning the middle class? I mean, Introduction 814, which is also something you recommended in your paper, that has now gone into effect.
Yes.
This is one of the best ordinances protecting against discrimination against the unemployed.
Right.
And it passed by a wide margin in the New York City Council.
Yes.
Bloomberg vetoed it despite that, even though there was no way his veto would actually stop this piece of legislation. So, you know, this leads me to wonder, well, on one hand, is Introduction 814 going to do enough to help the long-term unemployment problem? And number two, is Mayor Bloomberg realistically looking at this serious problem if he goes ahead and says, well, I'm going to veto this because I want to show that I'm business-friendly?
Well, I mean, we knew that he was going to veto it. I think his veto was more a formality, that he wanted to make a statement. He was very clear that he thought that this was going to be frivolous legislation, that it would result in, you know, an onslaught of lawsuits against employers from unemployed people.
I think we've demonstrated with this program that unemployment is far from a frivolous issue. But to paraphrase the famous song, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. Low unemployment is having a difficult time in the Big Apple. And if we can't reduce unemployment in New York, how can we expect to reduce it anywhere else? But we do have a choice. We have the option of looking unemployment in the face and pressuring the right people on the local, state, and federal levels. Of course, this involves believing in something. Believing in something more than what novelist Richard Gates once identified as our own comfortable little goddamn mediocrity. That's our show. Don't forget to tune into our sister program, The Bat Segundo Show, which has just returned back to the airwaves after a long absence.
You can go to batsegundo.com and subscribe to the feed, which contains both Batsegundo and Follow Your Ears. Batsegundo airs every Tuesday. The last Tuesday of every month is devoted to Follow Your Ears. You can also visit our website at followyourears.com for all our episodes. Our thanks to Barry Cohen, the many unemployed people who gathered at Barry's lecture, Professor William Dickens, Barbara Garson, Mitchell Hirsch, and Dr. Michelle Holder for their time, compassion, and wisdom. Remember, follow your ears. Curiosity is too essential to existence to ignore. You never know what little nugget you might pick up. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.